This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As extreme rain, fires, heat, storms become the new normal, the supposedly advanced civilization cannot protect their elders properly. From Hurricane Katrina to California fires, 70 to 85% of fatalities were adults over the age of 65. This lack of climate readiness comes as America approaches another tipping point. In 10 years, the country will have more people over 65 than kids under 18. Japan is already there. Danielle Argoni has 25 years' experience in public planning. She worked with nonprofit groups like ARP, the American Association of Retired Persons. She carried leadership roles in the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Danielle is currently Managing Director of Policy and Solutions at National Housing Trust. With her master's degree in city and regional planning from Cornell, Argoni just published her prescription to keep more citizens alive during climate disasters. Listeners in every country need to consider this book, Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation. Living in D.C., but always in California, Danielle Argoni, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
In Europe's most deadly heat wave of 2003, tens of thousands of French seniors died while their families were away on summer vacation. What is the situation for older adults in the United States as record long-lasting heat settles in?
Well, I think that older adults in the U.S. face a predicament as we encounter more hotter days, seasons that last longer, particularly in regions that are unaccustomed to heat. So I'm thinking specifically of the Pacific Northwest in 2021 and 2022, where a heat dome settled over the top of the region and took the lives of more than 1,000 people, many of whom were older adults. And I think that the reason for that is the particular risk that older adults face with heat in particular is due to a few different things. One, I think there is the reality that very many older adults in the U.S., perhaps similar to France, live on their own. So I think there's a presumption sometimes that older adults are living in congregate settings and in institutional settings like nursing homes. The reality is that that's only about 4% of older adults. About 96% live in the community, and among those, around 30% live by themselves. So what that means is that when someone is encountering the effects of heat-related illnesses, those symptoms might go unnoticed. That could be a lack of balance. It could be disorientation. It could be any other sort of symptoms that express or that demonstrate that a heat illness has set in, but there's no one there to notice it. There's no one there to take action. The notion that older adults are always going to be cared for by someone nearby is a flawed assumption, because in reality, there's a lot of people who do not have the benefit of someone nearby to care for them. I think another reason that particularly implicates older adults in the U.S. is because of what that means for utility costs. So assuming that a home has air conditioning, and what we found in the Pacific Northwest is that a lot of homes were not designed with air conditioning at all because they had never historically needed that. Summers didn't get hot enough to warrant it. Assuming there is air conditioning in place, the cost of operating that air conditioning can really be a burden, particularly for older adults who live at or below the poverty line, as is the case for about 15% of older adults in the U.S. And I think when you layer those costs on top of housing costs that are already straining the budgets for many older adults, it gets older adults into a situation where they're really having to make trade-offs between how much they can afford to run the air conditioner and how much heat they can, discomfort they can withstand. And that's a pretty perilous situation to be in part because we know that once those symptoms have set in, once the effects of heat illness have kicked in, and if there is no one nearby to respond to those, it can oftentimes lead to death. Tragically, what we know is that 12,000 people die each year in the U.S. from heat-related illnesses, and of those, 80% are people over 60 for some of the reasons I just discussed.
And climate change is much more than heat. Why do so many seniors die during big storms like Hurricane Ian that hit the Gulf Coast of Florida in September 2022?
Yeah, that too is another, I think, tragic illustration of how older adults do oftentimes display a particular vulnerability that may not be understood by planners, may not be present in the broader population or with younger people. In particular, I think mobility is a big challenge that implicated people's ability to respond appropriately in Hurricane Ian. So what we know of older adults is that it's a very diverse group. There's, you know, some older adults are very financially resilient, very physically fit and in great health and have lots of support around them. There are others who are not. And in general, what we know of older adults is about 20% of older adults don't drive and about 40% have ambulatory limitations. So both of those are mobility challenges, right? Mobility challenges within the home and the community and mobility challenges in terms of being able to drive yourself someplace, particularly to evacuate. So when you layer those two realities onto the sort of plight of people who live in the region affected by Hurricane Ian, and what we've seen in time and time again, including in the Maui wildfires, is that there's really not enough planning that has gone into the needs of people who don't drive, who no longer drive. And again, I'll say 1 in 5 people over 65 don't drive anymore or have other sort of ambulatory limitations. So that lack of ability to frankly just get out of harm's way is a big part of why events like Hurricane Ian or the Maui wildfires are truly devastating for some older adults.
And the suffering for older adults continues long after the smoke settles or the winds die down. You write, quote, impacts associated with disasters tend to have a long tail, manifesting months or years after the event in the form of effects on both physical and mental health. Please take a minute or two to explain those impacts on older adults beyond the death toll.
Yeah, what we've seen in the research is that, first of all, there's great research that's been done to illustrate the impacts of disasters on, for example, people who have recurring medical treatments. So imagine cancer treatments or dialysis. Treatments that are required on a regular and sustained basis to address an underlying medical condition. We know that interruption of those treatments by a disaster of the kind that we've described, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or Ian, it results in a higher death rate for those who live in the disaster-affected area than for those who were not confronted with a disaster. It also takes a real toll, I think, whether you know, you're able to maintain your life in the place where you've been living or whether you need to evacuate. That is a real toll on people sort of from a mental health perspective. There's a real trauma that's involved in living through an event of a magnitude of the kinds that we've talked about, going back to Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina, where it's this massive disruption in people's lives in terms of how they access care, how they access support. That takes a toll as well. And there was a study, I believe, of Superstorm Sandy older adults that showed even as far as 3 years after the event that there were negative mental health effects from that. So whether it's interruption of treatment, whether it's sort of prolonged mental health impacts, or whether it's frankly just the effects physically in a home that live beyond the disaster itself, so homes that were damaged in a disaster that have not been able to be fixed or rehabilitated, or homes that suffer from repeat flooding, often result in conditions that exacerbate existing health conditions. So that it's things like black mold in homes that have a really incredibly disproportionate effect on older adults who are already living with respiratory disease.
And I also recall high senior heat deaths during the Chicago heat wave of 1995. Many of the fatalities were people of color. And in some areas, seniors living in high crime areas were afraid to open their windows or doors, and so they died in their overheated homes. There are socioeconomic factors, too, in this picture of high climate risk for older adults, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the tragedy here is that all of these risks that are associated with age and with climate change sit on top of what we already know are inequitable health outcomes that are differentiated by race. We know that life expectancy varies widely depending on where you live, what zip code you live in, because that is tied to your access to health care, to healthy food, to regular care. All of these risks that we're talking about with climate and with age just exacerbate the underlying, frankly, inequities that already exist within our healthcare system. So the reason that's particularly, I think, challenging and troubling and frankly should be a call to action is because we know that older adults, non-white older adults, the rate of growth among that population is faster than the rate of growth for white older adults. We are going to become a more diverse cohort of older adults over time, more linguistically, more racially, more ethnically diverse as the years go on. And I think solving for those inequities that underlie some of the predicaments that older adults are going to find themselves in becomes part of addressing the climate challenge.
Well, another small factor I would add to your book's catalog of seniors' dangers, surveys show most climate deniers are older white men. We have a major American political party with some pretty old leaders against climate action and against health care, it seems. The state of Florida tried to prevent officials even saying the words climate change.
Yeah, that's right.
So why prepare or spend tax dollars on climate readiness when you think it's all a hoax?
Well, I think, you know, whether we call it climate change or not, I think there is a recognition that risk is increasing. And I think if it does, if people aren't compelled by the scientists telling the story, maybe they'll be compelled by their pocketbook. And certainly the insurance industry has accounted for this risk. That is going to be reflected in higher insurance premiums for a homeowner's insurance in some parts of the country, certainly for flood insurance in affected regions. And if that's not a wake-up call to people, I don't know what is. We know that, you know, because we have new data now about future projections, the flood risk profile for many communities has changed, which is going to result in very steep increases in their premiums. FEMA is going to be phasing those in, but we see effects in Florida, for example, where someone I believe was paying, you know, $1,000 a year, that or maybe $800 a year, that's going to go up to over $4,000 a year. When those kinds of effects start to happen, you can deny climate all you want, but the reality is that it's going to become more costly, more difficult to live in risk-prone areas. So for all those reasons and more, not to mention the fact that we are collectively aging as a country, that is a trend that we cannot reverse. There's no way that we could stem that tide. We have to plan for the day when we're going to be comprised of more older adults and really be honest and clear-eyed about the risks that that means both for them and the communities in which they live.
For older Americans, climate impacts are just part of a polycrisis. We've got inflation and high food prices, but harsh weather on steroids arrives as older adults are struggling to find affordable shelter that could save their lives. We see TV news footage with mobile homes used by so many seniors blown away or washed downstream. Talk to us about the seniors' housing crisis during climate change.
Yeah, I'm particularly troubled and frankly distressed over the conditions around housing for older adults. We know that, and there's a report that's going to be coming out just very shortly at the end of November from this Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, that in past years has shown that the housing cost burden among older adults has risen to the highest level ever. And that means older adults are paying more than 30% of their income for housing alone. So in their last report a few years ago, that had reached an all-time high. I fully expect that what we've seen with rent prices in the past few years and what we know of demographic change in the past few years, that number is going to go higher still. Already we know that I believe there's something like 14 million households that are headed by someone 75 or older. Of those, 45% say that they are paying more than a third of their income on housing. Among renters, it's three-quarters of older renters are paying more than 30% of their housing. So that's a lot of numbers, but what it really means is that older adults are strained financially to cover the cost of housing. And when you have that number of older adults strained at that level and the sort of national housing crisis that we find ourselves in, we are seeing already that whether it's seeking out mobile homes or manufactured homes as a solution, that increasingly is, in some cases, it remains a viable option. In other places, it doesn't, because what we've seen in some examples is when disaster or when private investors swoop into an area and buy up manufactured home communities, or in the case of disaster, burn through them, rendering them no longer livable, that those opportunities are not being restored, that you that therefore lose that affordable housing option in many communities. So manufactured housing essentially gets taken off the table as an affordable housing solution. For all those reasons and more, we're seeing an uptick, frankly, in the share of older adults that are unhoused. And one of the largest, you know, sectors now of people who are unhoused is people over 50. I believe more than 50% of our unhoused population is people over 50. And that's fully expected to grow when you think about the housing cost burden that we're asking older adults to endure. Unlike other ages, it's not that easy to go out and get another job, a second job, a third job to make ends meet. Not that we wish that on anyone, but we know that that's particularly unrealistic for many older adults. They simply can't close the gap on what they can afford to pay and what rents are. And I think that bodes a lot of poor outcomes for a lot of people if we're not able to bring greater focus to that challenge.
Well, the other tough problem you raise is more people live longer, the number of cognitively challenged seniors becomes staggering. We have Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and a whole lot of cognitive illnesses harming millions of people. Heat itself lowers cognitive ability when you're going through it. Talk to us about how all that impacts older people's responses and the need to plan for confused people during emergencies.
Absolutely. I was stunned, frankly, to learn in my research that 1 in 9 people over 65 live with dementia. And when you think about what that means on a daily basis, of course, what we know of people, you know, suffering from dementia is that routine and predictability and the ability to predict what is going to come, it becomes very important, that maintaining a sense of normalcy and predictability and familiarity becomes very important for people lest they become more disoriented. Well, when you're talking about a disaster situation, a duress situation, all of that goes out the window. People who might be relocated to a shelter, we've heard stories of people wandering from that location. That's already a risk with people who live with dementia, going back into areas that where they find themselves at greatest harm. And frankly, those who live with dementia in their own homes may be ill-equipped, maybe unable to frankly reconcile the news that they're receiving about the risks that are coming and then take action appropriately. That means more pressure than on caregivers, more pressure than on emergency responders to sort of account for those challenges. And again, I think it's just one of those blind spots that we have as planners, frankly, when we think about, you know, community resilience and what that looks like and how people will logically respond in the face of disaster. We fail to account for the fact that dementia interferes with that. Dementia presents a real risk to be able to clearly assess risk that you face and take action based on that. I have heard of some situations where devices can be employed that help trace people, that can help locate people should they wander. But, you know, shelters themselves and sheltering plans themselves need to account for the risk of people wandering who live with dementia, as well as other difficulties that their caregivers are going to be concerned about.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Danielle Aragone, author of the new book, Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation. Superstorm Sandy was a wake-up call for New York, and there are a lot of older adults living there. Daniel, from a resilience perspective, what came out of that?
Well, I applaud many of the folks involved in the Superstorm Sandy recovery, in part because it was, I think, really a wake-up call for our country in terms of just the sheer magnitude of damage and what that catalyzed in terms of a different approach going forward. I'll give a lot of credit to the New York Academy of Medicine, who back in 2014 developed a report to really try and understand what it was that occurred during Superstorm Sandy and how older adults fared during that disaster. And some of the recommendations that they came up with really hold true today. And it speaks to some of, I think, some core tenets that remain important in the form of things like better communication systems. How can we ensure that people are informed in ways that they will hear and access so that they can take appropriate action? It encouraged, if I'm not mistaken, I'm going off memory here, it encouraged local leaders to put in place better planning efforts specifically around mobility and access to safe shelters. So a lot of good thinking went into that back in 2014. When I circled back with New York Academy of Medicine in the writing of the book, it was clear to me, and I think clear to them, that not all of those recommendations had been implemented in the way they envisioned, in part because there wasn't really an accountability structure in place. It really wasn't any one entity's job to ensure that these recommendations were brought to the fore, in part because a lot of the way in which we plan for resilience is done in kind of a siloed fashion. So you have, you know, the Department of Transportation making decisions about transit and paratransit. You have the Department of Aging making decisions about in-home services and home and community-based services. You have the Department of Emergency Management making decisions about emergency response. I think that there's an opportunity for New York, particularly as they move ahead with two plans that they are seeking to implement. one of which is a commitment to become an age-friendly state, and that is leading to what is called a master plan for aging that the state is developing now, which my hope is that they really look back to that report in 2014 and bring some of those recommendations back to the fore, because it's an opportunity to assign those tasks to the right state agencies. The other thing that New York is doing is seeking to really be a leader on climate. And I think the degree to which those same recommendations can help drive how they move their climate agenda ahead can be really important. Those are, you know, some of the ways in which they could do that could be by prioritizing the, you know, electrification and use of renewable energy in places where older adults live, so that you're building in the infrastructure in the building, particularly in multifamily buildings where there happens to be a high number of older adults. If you can incorporate renewable energy into those buildings and provide backup storage, then you've eliminated some of the concern that emerged from Sandy, which was the power goes down and people can't access the services or the equipment that they need to remain safe in their home. So again, you know, by weaving some of those lessons in from Superstorm Sandy into the climate plan at the state level and the age-friendly master plan, I think both of those are an opportunity to really build on what was learned during Superstorm Sandy.
Talk to us about the ongoing role of community-based organizations when it comes to seniors and climate disasters.
Yeah, the importance of community-based organizations cannot be overstated. I think that we see time and time again that they, you know, fill in the spaces that are left by public entities who either are unable to provide the level of service that is needed because of funding or because of capacity or because of what they've been charged to do. So community-based organizations, I think, are really incredibly important. I've heard, you know, and read stories about how community-based organizations in Puerto Rico in particular really were the backbone of the recovery effort, and they played critical roles in delivering food and water and even helping with things like land title so that affected owners, particularly older adults, could get the kind of federal relief that they needed to rebuild. And that was all led at the community level. I think here in the continental U.S., community-based organizations play an equally important role in terms of, you know, I think of things like, you know, delivering Meals on Wheels support to households. Those are, you know, for people who live alone, the Meals on Wheels volunteer or staff person might be the only person that that person is in contact with in the course of a week or more. And so I think utilizing community-based systems like that to get information and support out to older adults is critically important. We saw this happen in Portland, Oregon, where they used some of the infrastructure of community-based organizations that had been propped up during COVID and repurposed that to get portable heat pumps, meaning air conditioners, into older adults' homes on the heels of the first heat wave in 2021 so that they didn't see the rates of death in 2022 that had occurred the prior year. And that was done because community-based organizations have the relationships with the older adults. They're a trusted source in many cases. They can be nimble and be very agile in how they provide support. I'll give one more example, which I think is a really inspiring one, which is from New Orleans, where a group called Together New Orleans is deploying community lighthouses throughout the city. And they came to that realization because they realized that as they transition from a response approach that no longer requires people evacuate because they saw the challenges of evacuation, particularly for older adults, now they've transitioned to an approach that helps people remain sheltered in place while the power goes out, which is a very common occurrence now post-hurricane. What they saw was that this community-based organization saw that they needed to be able to provide very decentralized, very neighborhood-accessible resilience hubs, or what they're called community lighthouses, so that older adults and other residents can easily access these centers, get access to electricity, to food, to water, to basic care. And that was only possible when they partner with community-based organizations like houses of worship, like health centers. And so because of that, they are ultimately building towards a network of more than a dozen, maybe even more than a couple dozen, of these community lighthouses scattered throughout the city that are navigable by older adults who live in the community, so that they can get the support that they needed. Again, that's only the response. A response like that can really best be done by a community organization. of course, it requires a lot of public support and philanthropic support to make it possible, but they're a critical part of the puzzle.
I also like the idea in your book about joint volunteer information centers. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was the Portland model that they developed during COVID. So that was a model that they developed. They called it JVIC. And what they did was harness a whole bunch of these community-based organizations, some of which were very sort of culturally specific. So a group that could best serve the Latino residents of and Spanish-speaking residents of Portland, another that served the Asian population in the region. And by cultivating relationships with groups that were very well understood and trusted by members of those groups, they were able to, again, deploy resources during COVID in the form of food or, you know, other kind of support mechanisms that were needed to be brought to people's homes during COVID. They could repurpose that same JVIC infrastructure in some ways, even though I think they called it something different by that time, in order to get these heat pumps out into people's homes. So I think it's a really interesting model that Portland piloted. I think they were unable to carry it forward on a long-term basis because of funding shifts. But there's a lesson in there about, you know, creating that network of community-based organizations, training them to be able to deliver services and support, and then repurposing that infrastructure to meet climate-related needs.
If we really care about older people, your book recommends fundamental changes to a wide range of institutions. It's a big project. And right now, more climate legislation in Washington seems unlikely. State action is possible in some places, but community action better in others. Where would you recommend our listeners put their activism to save older people during the climate crisis?
I think at the local level is a really important place to start. And in my mind, what that looks like is, first of all, at the most hyper-local level, taking a clear assessment of your own risks and that of people in your family and your community. What are the risks that we face going forward? What are the things that we need to do to prepare for that? And that might mean thinking about transitioning to renewable energy and battery storage, or thinking about getting air purifiers if you live in a place that's going to have more wildfire risk because you live in a home with someone who's got respiratory disease. But I would also say it's pressing your local leaders to ensure that when they're making decisions about housing or transportation investments or services, that they're really at least asking the question, how will this reduce risk for older adults in the face of our climate future? I do think that there's opportunities across the spectrum for local leaders to make decisions that better serve the needs of older adults. There's also a lot of opportunity, I think, with utilities, which sit outside of local government. But utilities can be brought more into the discussion here in terms of the important role that they play. You know, they could do things like encourage homes to be more energy efficient, provide support or rebates to bring down the cost of utilities so that the older adult in living in that home doesn't have to worry about what this means for my utility bill as they weigh whether or not they should turn on the heating or the cooling. So there are a diverse array of actors and players, I think, that can be involved. And I would hate to sort of leave out the opportunity to speak to the healthcare industry. I think the healthcare industry, you know, each person with their own doctor, and I think the medical industry more broadly, should be talking about climate change more proactively with older adults, and specifically talking about how the risks that they face are going to be intersecting with the chronic conditions that they live with. The National Council on Aging reports that 80% of older adults live with two or more chronic conditions. And I think it's worth taking a moment to talk with one's doctor about how those conditions intersect with the climate risks to come.
Yes, in 2017, I did a show called Has Your Doctor Told You? And my guest was Colorado emergency physician Jay Lemery with his book, Enviromedics. So there is definitely a conversation that should be happening that isn't yet. From the National Housing Trust, we've been speaking with longtime social planner and senior advocate Danielle Aragone. Her new book, Climate Resilience for an Aging Nation, is both a diagnosis and a handbook for action. You can find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org and check out www.resilienceforanagingnation.com. Daniel, thank you for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. It's been a joy to be here.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.